From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air Weekend. Today, Sarah Jessica Parker. In Sex and the City, she starred as a single woman. In her current HBO series, Divorce, she plays Frances, who in the first episode tells her husband,
I want to save my life while I still care about it. I don't love you anymore. I want a divorce.
Also, a third-generation Jehovah's Witness, Amber Scora, talks about leaving the faith and starting a new life. She was taught as a child not to focus on the future because the end of the world was imminent.
So because the world is ending, why would you go to college? They strongly discouraged you from going, anyone from going to college. Why would you get a career? A career would just be a distraction.
And Ken Tucker reviews two country hits with a hip-hop sensibility.
I got the horses in the back.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from State Farm, whose agents know that your car and home are more than just big purchases. They're a big part of your life. You put the time into making them your own. So now it's time to protect them with your own personal State Farm agent. Not only do they truly get you, but they'll be there for you when you need them. And with over 19,000 agents in neighborhoods across the U.S., there could be one just around the corner. More at statefarm.com or 1-800-STATE-FARM. State Farm, here to help life go right.
My guest, Sarah Jessica Parker, stars in the HBO comedy drama series Divorce, which started its third and final season Monday night. She's also an executive producer of the show. Her previous HBO series, Sex and the City, ended its six-year run 15 years ago. In Sex and the City, Parker played Carrie Bradshaw, a single woman in New York who writes a newspaper column called Sex and the City, drawing on her own experiences with romantic relationships, friendships, and fashion. In Divorce, Parker plays Frances, a working woman, wife, and mother of two, living in a suburb of New York on the Hudson River. In the first episode, she realizes she wants a divorce. Season one was about how the couple navigated untangling their lives and ending the marriage. Season two was about figuring out their lives after the divorce. In season three, they're each in new relationships. Let's start with a clip from the pilot episode. Frances and her husband Robert are at a party hosted by a couple that's been married 8 years. But the host and hostess got into a fight that ended when she tried to shoot him and fortunately missed. That incident leads Frances to have this conversation. Here's Sarah Jessica Parker as Frances and Thomas Hayden Church as her husband, Robert.
How do you go from 8 years of a happy marriage to wanting to blow someone's head off? What if the same thing happens to us?
I would never try and blow your head off.
Are you sure? Are you really sure you would never try and blow my head off?
Yes, I am sure. Wait, hang on. Are you not sure?
When you threw my laptop out the window, I specifically remember thinking that I wanted to hit you in the face with the ceramic, you know, the Chinese ceramic cat thing with the little wavy arm. I wanted to smash the cat and scalp you with one of the shards.
What the f***? Are you drunk? That's fine.
You spent last Christmas fishing in Alaska.
No. Hang on a second. That's the only time of the year that the Chinook salmon run in those numbers. And you said you didn't mind.
I didn't mind. It was the best Christmas I have had in years.
You're welcome.
Sometimes I come home from work and I'm happy. I actually feel happy. And then I see your car there parked and I realize you're home. And my heart sinks.
Is this about my old job? Is that what this is about?
I want to save my life while I still care about it. I don't love you anymore. I want a divorce. Oh, God, Robert.
Now let's skip ahead to Monday night's episode of Divorce. At this point, Robert is engaged to his new girlfriend. She's pregnant, and Frances, who doesn't know about the pregnancy, has just come by to show Robert the latest co-parenting schedule for their kids.
What's going on, Robert?
Yeah, I wasn't going to say anything until... We were a little farther.
Jackie's pregnant.
Yeah.
I didn't know that you...
It wasn't planned. It just happened.
I got it.
Wow. All over again.
Yeah.
Sarah Jessica Parker, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's been too long since you were last on our show. Welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
I think you don't have to be divorced to have experienced some of the problems in a relationship that when they really get out of control will lead to divorce. But, you know, every relationship has its bumps. So what were some of the things you wanted to explore in divorce? Like, you're a co-creator of the series, you're an executive producer of the series and the star. Mm-hmm. You initiated the idea and then brought in Sharon Horgan to kind of really create and write it. So what direction did you want to head in and why did you want to head there?
Well, I wanted to, I think we all wanted to, Sharon Horgan, myself, and Allison Benson, my producing partner. I think we were most interested in the smaller stories of divorce, the stories of divorce that are not accompanied by high-powered attorneys and people that have divorced countless times and have strategic plans behind it. I think we wanted to tell the story, the first season, of just being completely embedded in battle in divorce, people who find that they are terrible at divorce because they've never done it before and they don't know how to be strategic, that they're, you know, the counsel that they get from friends and attorneys can be not helpful, that smart, decent people become villains and behave poorly. I think we wanted to explore how money affects divorce when you don't have money, when you have debt, when there are children involved, and those realities and the stories that tend to be smaller. We were excited about the real human side of that for both parties.
So speaking of divorce, so your parents divorced when you were 3 and a half. So what was the arrangement for you growing up? Because memory, I think, basically starts at around 3 and a half. So you probably don't even remember when your parents were together.
Yes, and in fact, I think I was even younger. I think my parents might have, or perhaps they originally separated when I was maybe 18 months or even two. I'm sort of mystified by how little trauma I feel about it. Like, I can't pretend that it was in any way sort of shaped my own feelings about marriage or a relationship or what I wanted to do specifically with this show. And that might be because my mother remarried fairly quickly and, you know, my father had a relationship fairly soon after that, and a majority of my life, these were two separate people that I didn't have to separate from myself. I don't know if that makes sense. Like, I knew them only as separate people, separate of one another, and I lived exclusively with my mother. I think it was 1967 or 68. The agreement was loose, fluid. We saw our father when we could, when his life allowed, when our life allowed. And I think they made it up as they went along. They were sort of creating the agreement in real time. And they found a way to do it without an enormous amount of trauma to the children. And we were able to maintain relationships as adults. And I think that is a victory, you know, that we maintain those relationships by choice.
So you didn't grow up thinking that marriage is forever. How did that affect your view of what marriage is or could be, whether marriage was even worth pursuing?
I just said to a friend the other day that I don't think I ever dreamed of being married, or I didn't have fantasies about being a parent or being married. But I really don't think it's related to my upbringing. I think my family shaped me, but not the marriage. I think what was more impressive to me growing up were the things my mother wanted for me. Played a much bigger role in my life and in my siblings' life than her relationship with my father.
What were those things that she wanted for you?
She wanted us to be exposed to the arts. She wanted us to be readers. She wanted us to be curious.
She wanted us to see everything we could see, hear everything we could hear, eat everything we could eat. She wanted us to feel that we were witnessing the unfamiliar.
So now that you're in your mid-50s and the Sirius X in the City ended nearly 15 years ago, looking back on the series, how does it look to you? What do you think really holds up? What do you think may look dated now? Because culture changes so quickly.
Looking back, and one must look back at all of it, not this, you know, not the latter years, which maybe it might be easier. I would say, yeah, there's a lot that speaks of its time, but there is some truth, I think, in that, even if it's not ideal, frankly. I think I was having a conversation with somebody about, obviously, the lack of diversity in terms of women of color. For instance, let's start with that, right? It's hard to not see that, I think. I think lots of people would agree. What's interesting is that was reflective of a particular group in New York City, right, who were not surrounding themselves with women of color. Their friend group on the Upper East Side, it was not colorful. So there is that. And I think, you know, if you made the show today, that would be really, one must look at how you would want to tell that story in all its truthfulness. I think the way we talk about money was very specific of its time. I think, you know, we were having conversations about women's empowerment, but they were before what's happened in this country in the last 2 years, less than 2 years.
Before the Me Too movement.
Correct, yeah. But they weren't the kinds of conversations women are having today, but that's because culturally and politically, that was where we were.
Can you give me an example of like a conversation or an experience that you, that was interpreted one way then that you'd interpret differently now?
I would bet that in the pilot, I don't say this with a huge amount of conviction, but there's a whole sort of the thesis of Carrie's thesis is I want to have sex like a man, right? I think I would be so interested to watch that today and wonder what that conversation would be like today. That's just one. I think there would probably have been countless conversations with Miranda, Cynthia Nixon's character, talking about, you know, her work, how she's treated at the office. I think there were lots of conversations about how she felt she was being treated as a partner in a law firm or not yet partner in a law firm, or what was expected of her to become a partner in a law firm. Be so curious to hear everybody's opinions about that. You know, what advice they were giving Miranda, how out of touch that might sound today. But that wasn't because Michael Patrick King and Darren Star, or initially Darren Star and then Michael Patrick King, were not evolved. They were pushing that conversation as far as we had yet gone.
Mm-hmm.
And for many, that was too much, even.
My guest is Sarah Jessica Parker. She's now starring in the HBO comedy drama series Divorce. We'll talk more after a break, and Ken Tucker will review country hits with a hip-hop sensibility by Lil Nas X and Blanco Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the new podcast, Overheard at National Geographic. It's a show where listeners get to fall down the rabbit hole with one of the real-life explorers hanging around National Geographic's headquarters. People who are swimming with whales, summiting Everest, and traveling to the edges of our big, wild, beautiful world. You've known what National Geographic looks like. Now hear what it sounds like. Overheard at National Geographic. Listen in, starting June 11th.
Let's get back to our interview with Sarah Jessica Parker. She stars in the HBO series Divorce, which started its third and final season Monday. She's also an executive producer of the series. And of course, she starred in the HBO series Sex and the City. Can I ask, like in your own life, you got into show business when you were a child, basically. Did you have experiences with men behaving inappropriately with you, trying to take advantage of you?
Yes, and it's interesting or curious to me that I didn't spend any time thinking about any of that until until the conversation was being explored beyond those initial New York Times articles, because those were so specific to Harvey. But it really wasn't, I would say, until about 6 or 8 months ago that I started recognizing countless experiences of men behaving poorly, inappropriately, and all the ways that I had made it possible to keep coming to work or to remain on set or to simply, as I've described it, just push it down, push it away, find a little space for it and move on. And really only on one occasion did I ever call an agent, and the agent stepped in, I will say, immediately without hesitation, had no problems calling on and calling out the parties that were behaving not only inappropriately, but perhaps even, I would say, they weren't living up to contractual obligations as well. But I always found a spot and really just didn't allow it to consume me. I don't know if I'm just, I don't know why, to be honest. I don't know why I either wasn't courageous or more destroyed by some of the things that I was privy to, I was on the receiving end of.
Did you know how to draw the line and say no? I think it's hard for when you're young, and especially if it's somebody who's in a position of authority, you know, who's either casting mm-hmm. you or directing you or mm-hmm. the adult star when you're the kid. I don't know what happened, so I'm just
that's right.
like throwing out some categories
all of
people.
It.
Yeah.
You can, that's right, you did it.
Okay, so how do you know how to say stop when you're the kid? And everybody else is the adult with the power and the authority and the knowledge and, you know, the acclaim and all of that.
Sometimes it was making deals, trying to be witty and clever and use information that I had about this other party, maybe their politics, maybe making a joke. If you continue doing that, I'll tell everybody that you're, you know, voting for George Bush in the next election, you know. I would try to find ways with language. I did things like have a friend spend the night and answer my phone.
Wow.
I remember in a hotel once,
yeah.
I asked a male friend of mine if he would stay in the hotel room with me and just answer the phone and simply say I wasn't there. I don't recall saying no. This is very weird about this, and I don't know if I'm ashamed of that or if I simply found a host of other words that said no in other ways. And I do think I probably was nervous about saying the word no, that it jeopardized my place, my work.
So it sounds like you found ways of blocking men who were speaking or behaving inappropriately without necessarily literally saying, no, you cannot do that. But you found ways to stop them anyways.
Yes, I think I found ways as best as I was able, yes.
And why do you think that you didn't think about this until like the Me Too movement? And then you started kind of putting it together and seeing a pattern and feeling, yeah, that happened to me.
I think no matter how evolved you think you are, how modern you think, well, I will say no matter how evolved or how modern I thought I was, I think that I didn't feel entirely in a position, no matter what my role was on set, I didn't feel as powerful as the man who was behaving inappropriately, which just strikes me as just stunning to say out loud, because there were plenty of occasions where it was happening and I was in a different position and I was as powerful. I mean, I had every right to say, this is inappropriate. I could have felt safe in going to a superior and say, and in fact, I will say, when there was a situation with somebody and I did go to my agent because I felt I was no longer able to convey how uncomfortable this was making me, how inappropriate it was, and also that it was crossing lines outside of this personal exchange. I felt like if a government authority was witness to what was happening, you know, if it was an environmental issue, OSHA would have been called in, you know, like if we were shooting and it was 2 degrees, they would have said no. So I called my agent and it was fascinating. Within hours, everything had changed. And in fact, I will also say, he said to them, if this continues, I've sent her a ticket, a one-way ticket out of this city where I was shooting, and she will not be returning.
Wow. So it was effective in getting the inappropriate behavior to stop. But what was life for you on the set after that?
It wasn't perfectly pleasant, but I didn't have to be coy any longer, and I didn't have to dread a potential conversation. I didn't have to listen to jokes about me or my figure or what people thought they could talk me into doing. You know, all these men, and that stopped. I mean, the nature of the person who I felt was really the instigator, though, you know, this was a grown man, a big movie star. and, you know, he was baked, meaning his personality, it was cooked, and he was a formed person, and that wasn't going to change. But I felt certainly better and safer, like I could finish what I had agreed to do.
When Girls came on HBO, a lot of critics and viewers started comparing it to Sex and the City because it seemed like, well, this is like a new generation's version and this generation's story of being in its 20s. And I think the characters were younger on Girls than in Sex and the City, but that their story is like really different. Their attitudes toward sex is different. The kinds of lives they're leading is different. They have a lot less money. So did you make those comparisons in your head too? I'm really curious, like, did you watch Girls and did you compare it?
I've never seen Girls. It's terrible saying that.
How come?
But I've never seen, I've never seen Breaking Bad. I've not seen most of what people are talking about in television, and it's not me avoiding anything, I assure you. I will also tell you that I've not seen the finale for Sopranos, so don't say anything about it. I stepped away from watching television not because I wanted to, but because I eventually had 3 children. This is the real truth. I'm going to be completely honest. I had 3 children, and I would have fantasies about watching all of it. And when I would go to a dinner, I could join in the conversation and contribute and have my opinions and defend or join in the criticism. But it would get to be 9 or 10 o'clock at night, and I was also a working mother, and I just couldn't do it. I just stepped away from scripted television. I will say that I did watch House Hunters International, but that didn't ask anything of me.
I don't know the show.
And so House Hunters International? Oh, Terry.
Yeah.
It's a show where you can watch people travel and try to find an apartment in...
So it's kind of like house porn.
Somewhere. No? Yes. Yeah. And they just are looking for an apartment, say, in Peru.
Uh-huh.
Or a home because they've been transferred and they need to find a home in Stockholm. And if you have wanderlust like I do, it, you know, it's like takes care of you a little bit. But that was like what I could do at night. And,
right. Yeah.
And or read. And then once I was removed from scripted television, with some exception, then I couldn't jump back in because I've been overwhelmed by the choice where to begin.
Weren't you just a little curious about Girls, though?
I remain curious about Girls, and I will see it. I will. There is going to come a time where I will be able to sit down and watch Girls and lots of other fantastic shows and shows that have been really meaningful to people and people have made connections with, and they watch over and over again. And I will, I, you know, I've never seen The Office. I've never seen The Office.
Right, yeah.
Isn't that mad? I mean, it's just crazy. I've seen the British, the original Office.
Mm-hmm, when you had time.
Yeah, like there's just something happened. Like I used to go to the baseball games. Like I used to watch baseball. I used to watch baseball.
Sarah Jessica Parker, it's been just great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Oh, Terry, it's such a total delight, a thrill, a privilege. So thank you so, so much for having me.
Sarah Jessica Parker stars in the HBO series Divorce. The third and final season began Monday. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of two country music hits with a hip-hop sensibility, Lil Nas X's Old Town Road and Blanco Brown's The Get Up. Old Town Road found itself in the center of a controversy when Billboard magazine initially removed it from its country sales chart for being not country enough. Ken says that Old Town Road and The Get Up are made by African-American musicians with a sense of history and a sense of humor.
Can't no more. I'm gonna take my horse to the Old Town Road. I'm gonna ride till I can't no more.
I got the horses in the back.
One of the biggest hits this past spring is sticking around to be one of the biggest hits of the summer. Lil Nas X's Old Town Road is an interesting piece of music that behaves like a novelty song. What might immediately strike your ear is the use of a banjo, not your usual hip-hop instrument. Then there's the tempo, a loping beat that does a great job of making you picture Lil Nas X sitting on a horse that's trotting across an Old West desert. In this context, the languid vocal comes across as a drawl.
I got the horses in the back, horse stock is attached. Head is matted black, got the boots black to match. Riding on a horse, ha, you can whip your Porsche. I've been in the valley, you ain't been up off that porch. Now, can't nobody tell me nothing. You can't tell me nothing.
Maybe you've seen the video for this song that features Lil Nas X performing with country music guest star Billy Ray Cyrus. Old Town Road traveled a rocky road to success. Early on in the song's run, Billboard dropped it from its country music chart, saying the song, quote, does not embrace enough elements of today's country music. This was, of course, ludicrous, verging on something more serious. Public outcry made it an even bigger hit, and the song went back on the country charts, as well as the pop and hip-hop charts. Lil Nas X recently released an EP of 7 diversely styled songs that suggest he's not a one-trick pony. Another artist, Blanco Brown, has a single that mixes hip-hop with country in both rhythm and instrumentation that is something altogether different. It's a new novelty hit called The Get Up.
Right now, I just need you to get real loose. Get comfortable. Grab your loved ones, or grab your love partner. And if you're by yourself, no worries. Just follow after me. Yeah. Gonna do the two-step, then cowboy boogie. Grab a sweetheart and spin out with him.
The Get Up is a devilishly clever number combining hip-hop rapping with a line dance rhythm. In the video for the song, Blanco Brown does a funky two-step that's caught on among both country and hip-hop audiences. Until now, Brown was best known within the industry as a producer. He's worked with Chris Brown, Pitbull, and Childish Gambino, among others. The Get Up isn't a masterpiece of songwriting, but it sure is catchy. A perfect summertime hit.
To the left now. To the right, to the right. Now take your left hand and put it on your side. Gonna roll your shoulders. Do the slip and slide. This next part's my favorite part, cause it's time to shine.
gonna do the two-step, then cowboy boogie. Grab a sweetheart and spin out with him. Do the hold down and get into it. Take it to the left now and dip with it. Don't throw down, take a sip with it. Now lean back, put your head.
Send it. It's simple, you can do it.
Slide to the left.
If you want to get serious about this, Old Town Road and The Get Up are the latest examples of the way black musicians' interactions with the country genre are most often treated like unusual events. That Lil Nas X's song had to pass some sort of purity test to join the Billboard country chart is, to put it mildly, distasteful. The African-American presence in country music extends back centuries, of course, at the very least as old as the banjo itself. Nevertheless, it's great to hear these two songs in the current country context, providing enlightenment as well as entertainment.
Ken Tucker reviewed Lil Nas X's Old Town Road and Blanco Brown's The Get Up. Coming up, we talk with Amber Scora about being a third-generation Jehovah's Witness who left her marriage and her faith and was then shunned by friends and family. This is Fresh Air Weekend.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. Support for NPR comes from WHYY, presenting The Pulse, a podcast that takes you on adventures into unexpected corners of health and science. Plastic in the guts of deep sea creatures, crying after anesthesia, building your own internet. Each episode is full of fascinating stories and big ideas. The Pulse, available where you get your podcasts or at WHYY.org.
I want to read you the headline of an op-ed in the New York Times that recently caught my attention. It read, "Surviving the Death of My Son, After Surviving the Death of My Faith." That essay, by my guest Amber Scora, is about the shocking loss of her 4-month-old baby boy and then grieving without the reassurances and answers that her former faith would have provided. The essay was adapted from Scora's new memoir, Leaving the Witness, about her life as a third-generation Jehovah's Witness. She used to be a faithful believer. In her hometown, Vancouver, Canada, she knocked on doors missionizing, armed with copies of the Witness's publication, The Watchtower, trying to warn people that Armageddon was imminent and they would soon die and leave no trace behind unless they converted. Then she went to China, where the religion is outlawed, and tried to missionize there. While in China, she started questioning the dogma she was taught that she was now trying to teach others. She started challenging the lower position of women in the faith. And she broke some of the rules. As a result, elders shut her out of the religion. She was shunned, officially considered an apostate, which meant family and friends within the faith were obligated to stop communicating with her. She now lives in New York. Amber Scora, welcome to Fresh Air. I think the only familiarity most Americans have with Jehovah's Witnesses are what they've been told when witnesses go door to door trying to convert people. And you used to do that back when you lived in your hometown, Vancouver. What did you tell people when you did it in Vancouver, when you knocked on their door and tried to convince them they should become a Jehovah's Witness?
That's a great question, and it's hard to answer because I often didn't get much of a chance to tell people what I wanted to tell them, because when you're a Jehovah's Witness in much of the Western world, most people don't answer their doors, or if they do, before you can get a word in, they usually tell you they're not interested. But what I wanted to tell them was essentially our message was that the end of the world was coming, but that there was a way to be saved, and the reason, the purpose for our visit was to save them. And it wasn't just about the end of the world. The reason why we felt like we had a really positive message was that if they converted to become one of Jehovah's Witnesses, they could live forever in paradise on earth.
Okay, so when Armageddon happens, believers, Jehovah's Witnesses, will be in this earthly paradise. What happens to everybody else?
Essentially, Armageddon is God's war to end wickedness. So that means that anyone who isn't following the true faith, which in Jehovah's Witnesses' mind is themselves, will be cut off, destroyed, leaving over in this paradise only the people who are abiding by God's laws, a.k.a. the Jehovah's Witness doctrine.
So what were some of the strict rules you had to live by that were different from strict rules that people follow who are orthodox or who are fundamentalist?
Well, it's interesting. Yeah, Jehovah's Witnesses, over the years, they sort of came up with different things that started to differentiate them from mainstream Christianity. A few of the more notable ones that people are aware of are that they don't celebrate birthdays, they don't celebrate Christmas, really almost any holidays they don't celebrate. And the reason for this is because a lot of those holidays and traditions have pagan roots. Jehovah's Witnesses believe that they're the one true, pure Christianity. And so they take it upon themselves to look for things to make sure that their worship is the most pure. Because it's an apocalyptic religion, the thrust of almost everything you do when you're part of a religion like this has to do with the fact that the world is ending. So because the world is ending, why would you go to college? They strongly discouraged you from going, anyone from going to college. Why would you get a career? A career would just be a distraction. You only need enough money to survive, because when Armageddon was going to come tomorrow or the next day or the next week, you didn't need to focus on a retirement plan or anything like that. So it really affected the way you lived your life, in that you were living for some future that was about to come any minute, and you weren't really participating in this world in the way that other people did, because this world wasn't the real life.
So when you were in your teens, you had a boyfriend and you kissed and you touched. It wasn't sex per se. You know, it wasn't intercourse. You were just kissing and touching. But he decided at some point that you had to confess to the elders. So tell us a little bit about why he decided you had to confess to what you'd done and what that process of confessing was like.
Well, in our religion, we had been taught for our whole lives that God could see everything we did, and that if we crossed a line into immorality and we hid it, it was much worse than even the immorality itself, and that when Armageddon came, we'd be killed for that, for hiding those acts that we had done, performed, and made ourselves unclean. So the way to overcome this sin you had committed was to tell the elders in the congregation. The elders were older men who were appointed to basically shepherd the flock. So they looked after giving talks and sort of administrative matters in the congregation, but also one of their main roles was to basically form a committee anytime any sin was committed, hear what the sinner had done, and then decide, basically judge the sinner as to whether they could stay in the congregation or whether the sin was severe enough or the person unrepentant enough that they had to be kicked out or disfellowshipped from the congregation.
So that first time you went before the elders, I guess you were repentant enough. But the second time, after you had actually had sex with your boyfriend, you were apparently not repentant enough and you were disfellowshipped. You were around 18 years old at the time. What did it mean to be disfellowshipped?
So disfellowshipping is a means of excommunication. And what happens effectively is that when the elders determined that you were not repentant enough, they would make an announcement at the congregation meeting. They would go to the platform, stand at the podium, and just say, Amber Scora has been disfellowshipped. They wouldn't say why, but it was an announcement to let everyone know that they had to stop associating with you, even saying a greeting to you. Disfellowshipping was just a complete shunning of the sinner. So what that effectively meant was that you lost your contact with your entire community, including your own family. They had to also abide by the disfellowshipping. And the way to get back, of course, if you wanted to get back, they left the door open. But the means of doing that was that while you were disfellowshipped, you had to show your repentance by attending all the meetings, being very regular in showing up at the Kingdom Hall. However, no one was allowed to talk to you, and you sat in the back row while the meeting was on and left right as soon as it was over so that no one would have to talk to you.
Your father died while you were being shunned by everyone in your faith. You went to the funeral, but you had to sit in the back row. Now, your father had strayed himself. He had become an alcoholic, which I'm sure is not smiled on by Jehovah's Witnesses. So considering that he had strayed himself and that you were sitting in the back row because you weren't allowed to be an active participant in the funeral or in the mourning process. What was it like for you to be shunned like that at your own father's funeral?
It was obviously very difficult. But one thing you have to understand is that when you are a true believer in a organization in a highly controlled environment like this, everything that happens to you, you agree with. You think that it's deserved. So when I sat there in the back row, I knew that it was of my own doing. I was the one that had put myself into this position because I had been immoral. Mm-hmm. It was strange, though. My dad's best friend gave the prayer. And after that day, after the funeral, when my father died, it just gave me more impetus to want to go back to the faith, because I knew that the only way I would see him again was if I were a Jehovah's Witness who survived Armageddon, because after Armageddon, the faithful would be resurrected to earth in our beliefs.
Was there a turning point for you where you decided you were done with your religion?
It took a long time. When you're raised in a really highly controlled group like this, a fundamentalist group, it takes a lot to unravel and unpick all of the beliefs, and because so much of your identity is wrapped up in it, your entire worldview is wrapped up in it. A lot of people think it's just like one day you wake up and you're like, oh my goodness, I had this epiphany. It's not the truth. It didn't really happen like that, but there were things along the way that started to bother me and that started to feel wrong, things that I hadn't seen before.
Before you fully left the faith, you left your husband. Now, leaving your husband basically meant that you were leaving the faith because you're not allowed to divorce. So when you ended the marriage, were you immediately shunned from the faith?
So events happened very kind of quickly, but I wouldn't have been ultimately shunned from the faith just for ending my marriage. I probably would have gotten disfellowshipped, but I could have clawed my way back in as I had before. But what ultimately led to the complete ostracization was the fact that people became aware that I was having doubts about the faith. And what that is considered as in Jehovah's Witnesses is apostasy, which is essentially believing and then not believing, and is the actual worst sin a person can commit. It's worse than being a murderer or a child abuser, because that's the one sin that God will not forgive.
After you kind of succumbed to your doubts and you were shut out of your religion, you moved to New York from China. You got an apartment in the East Village. You couldn't get a job. You finally got one. You finally got a boyfriend. And you wanted to have a baby. Why was having a baby just especially important to you after having lost your faith and therefore having lost your family who shunned you?
After I had moved to New York and been there for a few years, I was getting to be later in my 30s, and I couldn't help but think about this big decision, whether I wanted to have a child or not. And of course, having a child was one of those things I had just always punted off as something I would do in the paradise. But when, you know, by this point, I've come fully to grips with my own mortality. And also, I wanted to have family again. Most of my family was shunning me. I had this sort of divide between my old life and my new life. And I wanted to fully live. I wanted to fully experience what it meant to be a person in this world. And ultimately, that thinking about it, I decided that part of that would be that I wanted to have a child.
And so you had a boyfriend, you weren't married, but you had a son with him. And then you had a 3-month maternity leave from your job. After that, you returned to work. And on, I think, the first day, you left your son, Carl, your baby son, Carl, at the daycare center. You returned back to the daycare center to nurse him at lunchtime. Would it be too painful to ask you to describe what happened when you got back to the daycare center?
Yeah, I left work. It was the first time I had ever left him. And I ran back to the daycare center. It was just a couple blocks away from my job. And when I got there, I didn't know anything was wrong because everything had happened so fast, no one had notified me. But when I walked in the door, I saw one of the daycare assistants waving me. All the children were in the sort of kitchen area, and she was waving me to go beyond to the main play area. And when I turned the corner, I saw my son laying on a change table, and the daycare owner was doing CPR on him, and his lips were blue. So, I mean, you can imagine the shock, because I didn't even know that anything was wrong. So what had happened was, well, no one knows. She had put him down for a nap, she said, and then went to wake him up because she knew I was coming back to breastfeed him at my lunch hour, and he was already dead.
I just can't imagine what that was like for you.
Honestly, sometimes I can't imagine. Like, it's so awful that sometimes I can't believe it's real.
So a few years earlier, you would have had answers to explain what happened, and you would have had the confidence of knowing that you'd be reunited with your son in Armageddon on the earthly paradise. But now, your son died and you were living without answers. You had no faith to fall back on. What is it like for you now to live with the uncertainty of not knowing how or why your son died, not knowing why anybody dies, not knowing what happens to somebody after they die?
I think because before in my life, I had such clear answers to all these questions. When I realized that they had no basis in reality, I went to the other side where I just learned to accept that there was mystery, that there were things in this life that we couldn't understand. And also I was forced, maybe more than anyone else, to find a way to feel comfortable in that. And I kind of have. And it's sort of related to this kind of a spiritual feeling I think I've had my whole life, which I used to chalk up to being a religious experience, but I think more now of as a spiritual experience, just that there's the numinous or the magical all around us, and life is made up of these moments where if you choose to notice them, they're around you. And because those things, like, say, the love I saw in my son's eyes for me when he was a baby, are so inexplicable and transcendent, I think that they do feel magical. And if you think about them that way, you can just, in some way, appreciate the magic of it.
You got pregnant again within a year of your son's death, and you have a daughter now. Do you ever run into Jehovah's Witnesses, like, you know, in the street or on the train? And if so, do you talk with them? What are those interactions like, since you're basically considered an apostate and have been shut out of the faith?
I do. I live in New York City, so I see them every day because they're in the subways and on the streets doing their preaching. And in fact, for a while, I lived in Brooklyn Heights, which was, up until recently, the world headquarters of the Jehovah's Witnesses, where 3,000 Jehovah's Witnesses worked as volunteers. So I would see them every time I left my apartment. But when I see a witness in the subway now, there's a part of me, like, one impulse wants to hand them my book because I want them to be free to read the experience of someone who got through to the other side and has a happy life. But mostly when I see them, I don't confront them. I see that they're really nice people. In fact, I have many friends that I love that are Jehovah's Witnesses, even though they don't talk to me, but they're good people. They sincerely believe in what they've been taught, and their motives are good. I mostly just feel a sense of I feel sorry for them. I feel sad that the life that they will live will be lived for this myth. And maybe they'll never know, and maybe that's fine. But I can't help, now that I've seen both sides, feeling badly that that's the life that they are going to have.
Well, while you're feeling sad for them, they're probably feeling very sad for
you. Oh, for sure. They're definitely. And sometimes I think, obviously it's very anonymous in New York City. No one knows I'm an apostate. But sometimes when I walk by, they'll make eye contact with me, and I'll be like, can they see it in me that I know?
Amber Scorro, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
And I'm so sorry about the loss of your son.
Thank you.
Amber Scorro is the author of the new memoir, Leaving the Witness. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, Heidi Simon, Mooj Zaidi, Thea Chaloner, and Seth Kelly. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of digital media. I'm Terry Gross.